Hey, welcome to the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Time to go up the down staircase in the outdoor, make sense out of the senseless, and if it's all possible, we're going to find the obvious buried in the absurd. All together now, let's get to it. Glad to have you checking in from anywhere and everywhere around planet Earth. I'm here at the home studios just outside of Chicago, and glad to have you joining me. I got to tell you, the technology thing continues to amaze me. Listen, I'm basically an analog guy in a digital world. When I started in radio, I was still putting what looks like 8-track cassettes called carts in a cart machine that played commercials. And then when we were done with those, we'd take them out, put them through a magnetizer, or a demagnetizer, I should say, and everything that we had recorded on that cart was erased by magic. And then we'd do these over and over and over again. So when we did commercials, we would record them on these carts. As I said, they look basically like an 8-track cassette or slot machine like that. So when I started radio, there was this little unit that had 4 slots, looked like a toaster stuck up on its side. And we would put the carts in there and then have to press the play button. And they were either 15 or 30 seconds, whatever, or maybe a minute, whatever the customer had coming to them. And there must have been 500 carts in the cart rack. And you'd have to have them labeled by hand. Nothing digital. It was all by hand. So when I think of sitting down in my studio and flipping a couple switches and using this intranet thing to talk to the world, basically is just, not a day goes by when I do something on audio, especially the podcast or my show in New York on Sundays and in DC called The Tao of Music, that I just shake my head. I mean, it's astonishing, really. We take so much for granted because we've adapted to it to a greater or lesser degree so quickly. So it's like no big deal. It's a big freaking deal. I am so excited for this show. Stephanie Arnold is somebody who came across my nose last year. I was doing an event with Jennifer Weigel up in Lake Geneva at the Abbey Resort. It's called the All Souls Weekend. And it was a whole full day lineup of speakers and groundbreakers and newsmakers and earth shakers and frickin' rule breakers, man. And it was an amazing, amazing day of energy. And Stephanie Arnold got up and just slayed the room. And she has this special way about her because her life, I'm telling you right now, I've had a couple of these experiences. I call them near-life experiences because I shouldn't be here, but they pale in comparison to what Stephanie experienced. She is the author of the book 37 Seconds, Dying Revealed Heaven's Help, talked about going through this experience where she spent months having a premonition about dying and nobody believed her, and then it happened. So when she was talking about this in real time with real people at the Abbey, everybody in the room was leaning in. I saw people downstairs that worked there leaning in to hear what she had to say. So it's been a few months since we've talked. We've been rearranging schedules to get her on, and she joins me on the Life 2.0 podcast. Hey, Steph.
Hey, John. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm going to turn your volume up. You have a big voice off the air. Now you're like, well, hi.
I switched it to the PNP, so I'm probably doing something wrong.
No, you're fine. You're fine. So welcome.
Thank you so much.
You remember that day at the Abbey? Wasn't that something?
Oh, my gosh. You know, walking up the stairs, and we hadn't met in person, and all of a sudden you're like, yeah, and Stephanie Arnold's here. And I'm like, whoa, was this like a lead-in? And you just have such a great presence. And you're talking about everybody being captivated by me. I mean, everybody was holding their breath listening to your stories. You've been, you know, you've been around so many really big people, and you take up space, and your presence there shepherds them through anything that they're going through. And so it really grounds and grounded a lot of people while other people were hearing you speak. You know, because hearing someone like you say, look, I didn't believe in this stuff. This is where I came from. This is my life. You lean in because you're just like, this is a credible person, and this is somebody that I want to hear more from. So thank you again for connecting.
Absolutely. It goes both ways, right? Because I know that your life always wasn't like this.
Yeah.
And I think those are the greatest messengers / teachers / students / whatever that can give us the most learning in life. You know, listen, I don't want to dismiss anybody that I've ever known that are at the top of the quote echelon. You know, Wayne Dyer was a great friend of mine. He helped a lot of people around the world. But the Wayne Dyer before he became Wayne Dyer was the guy that I really wanted to spend time with, right? I mean, that eventually that gets to such a big thing. And your life growing up was, you know, I mean, it wasn't, there was no way to know that you're going to be in the place that you're at now.
That is correct. That is correct. And you were around when Wayne Dyer was alive, huh? Does that date you?
Yes, it does. We'll talk no more of that. Thanks for being on the show. Get the hell out.
It's great to have friends like you. See, now you're wishing I would have kept walking.
Yeah, no. But you know what? My point is that I've known so many people on the front side before their careers somewhat took off. And I think, you know, for the most part, they stay the course. But it's hard not to get burnished and tarnished when you're going up the ladder and you get to a point where you're Wayne Dyer in the world or Marianne Williamson and you got millions of people waiting to see if, you know, you take a breath. And if you do, then everything's better. But I've always found that the people who've made the biggest difference are not those people. Again, not taking anything away from them. They're playing the role they're supposed to play. But for example, at the Abbey, there was probably, I don't know, 100, 200 people there. No idea. And when I remember when you were speaking, I happened to look over the railing and there were four or five people who worked at the resort standing there listening to it. I'm thinking, you don't even know they're there. And that was so cool.
Thank you. Thank you for being an observer to that. Thank you.
So tell me a little bit about what it was like, you know, growing up, because I think the backstory is as important as the headline story.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Miami. I'm a Cuban Jew. And so I definitely have the Latina side. And my grandmother in Cuba growing up, she was considered santera, which is considered a witch. My father was a judge. His brother was a doctor. My aunt, their sister, was a businesswoman. So they didn't fully lean into the spiritual side of things. Mm-hmm. But my grandmother would always be like, you know, she believed in extrasensory perception and she would say things. And everybody was like, oh, that's the mal de ojo. That's the evil eye. Don't cross grandma's path, right? So I was closest to her. I looked a lot like her. And, you know, sometimes they say certain things are genetic, but I have no idea. So I just kept moving it forward. And I knew what I wanted to do at a very early age because at 14, I started working for a television news station, interning there, and then working in news for about 6 years. Went to college for broadcast journalism and theater. And then after that, I started working in infomercials and commercials. And, you know, when I was working in TV news, I realized very quickly that I didn't want to be in front of the camera because the person that was, you know, I wanted to know who the person was that was telling me what to do and what they were telling me what to wear and how to present myself. And I'm like, I want to be that person. And never really wanted to be controlled, I guess. Yeah, that might lead into my type A personality, but whatever.
Just a little bit.
So then, you know, I went into directing music videos and totally BS'd my way into my first music video, as one most certainly does.
Absolutely.
Surrounded myself with really great people. And then from that, I moved into reality TV, and I worked in reality television up until the point that I ran a division for Endemol. I ran their U.S. Hispanic division, which Endemol is one of the largest independent production companies in the world. They did Extreme Makeover Home Edition, Deal or No Deal, A Deal, Fear Factor, all these crazy shows. And, you know, I loved the work that I was doing. It definitely paid bills. I had two Emmy nods. I produced the tree lighting. I produced like the Puerto Rican Day Parade in New York. I did, you know, a bunch of specials. And then I was kind of stuck. And I think that the stuck part of it for me was I had all this money, I had the successes in the career, but there was something that kept pulling me back to wanting to understand more to life than just the materialistic side. I had for all optics, you know, the successes that I needed, but I had no one to share it with. And I was not understanding why that was, why I was attracting the men I was attracting. And so I did the whole eat, pray, love thing before the eat, pray, love thing. And spent some time with some Taoist priests in China, you know, meditated 18-hour days. I was like, let me silence everything and then hear what I really need to hear. And it wasn't until I, you know, went through this kind of, I guess spiritual awakening is the easiest way to say it, but it really was a need to feel connected to my soul, because I felt there was some level of, there was something happening empathically, but I couldn't put a finger on it. And when we get to my story, mm-hmm. you'll understand a little bit more. Like in my past, there were moments, intuitive moments, or knowings, as I like to call them, where you don't know how you know, but you just do. There were moments of those things that had happened my entire life, and I didn't give it as much credence until it was the one that saved
right.
my life.
Really got your attention. So let's fast forward to 2013, mm-hmm. and things really got uncomfortable, to say the least.
Yeah. So, you know, after I did this whole spiritual timeout for myself, I met my husband through a matchmaker, and when we met 6 months later, we got married. It was
you mean like a matchmaker, make me
yes,
a
actually
for real?
the one that's on TV, Patty
Get
Stanger.
Get out of here. Patty Stanger, yeah. No kidding.
Yeah, yeah, it's a crazy story, because I'm like, of course, a reality TV producer meets her husband
sure.
and soulmate through a reality TV star. So, so Patty introduced us 14 years ago, and it was kismet. It was like instant. 6 months later, we were married. He had a relationship and he had a daughter from a previous relationship. And then, we tried to have a child, and I had two miscarriages, and it was through IVF. And so the third one took, and then, she was fine 41 weeks later, gave birth, no problem, went back to work 8 days later. I had a C-section 'cause she was too big, but that was mm-hmm. the only complication. Mm-hmm. The second one was not that simple. So I got pregnant with Jacob, our second child, after the seventh round of IVF, and everything went swimmingly. And at the 20-week ultrasound, I was diagnosed with something called a placenta previa, which is basically when the placenta is growing on top of the cervix. You know, as the belly grows, it usually mm-hmm. will move out of the way, but worst case scenario is you might need a C-section. And I was okay with that. I'd had one before, right? So but there was something that sat wrong with me when they said that. And I looked at my husband, who, by the way, is a PhD in economics from University of Chicago, and he is a former Air Force pilot. So
very wide open, liberal-minded, all-encompassing. Yeah, I get the picture.
100%, right?
You're
it's
right.
data. It's
right,
data.
Right, right.
100% data, and very good under pressure and stress. So I look at him and I say, I don't know what this placenta previa is, because at the time I didn't. I said, but I don't want to be special in any category. I'm already a rare blood type in O negative, and which is 7% of the population. And I'm like, okay, I've got a bad feeling about it. And he's like, honey, we don't have all the information. You're getting great prenatal care. Let's just relax. You know, it's fine. And I go home like any other neurotic Jewish woman does, and you open up the computer and you just start Googling what is a placenta previa. And when I started with a placenta previa, it said all the things, you might need a C-section, whatever. But if it turns into an accreta, which is what Kim Kardashian had, the placenta marries itself to the uterus. If that happens, you might bleed. If that happens, you might need a hysterectomy. If that happens, you might hemorrhage. If that happens, you and the baby might lose your life. And I sat back when I read those words and I looked at my husband. It was like a cold wash over me. Mm. And I said, this is going to happen to us. The only difference is the baby's going to be fine. I said,
and you knew it
on that operating table. Yeah,
I knew it.
Yeah. I knew it. And for him, he's like, honey, what you're afraid of happening is a half of a half of a half of a half. Like, he's looking at the
right.
statistics
sure.
on it. It's so rare. You're crazy. You need to calm down. And, you know, lucky for me or unlucky for me, I don't know what it was. Like, I didn't care what anybody thought at that moment. It wasn't, people have asked me at book events, they're like, you know, after the 10th person told you you were crazy and nothing's wrong, I would have shut up. I said, then you would have stayed dead.
Yeah.
It's because I spoke up over and over and over again to anyone who would listen. If you saw me in the streets, how's your pregnancy going? I'd be like, I'm going to die. Like, it was so matter of fact, but also, you know, what we're feeling, you know, when you, The way that I can explain it is like you are being, and most people have never experienced, I've never experienced this, but if you're being buried alive and you're holding your breath, waiting, trying to grab onto whatever much oxygen you can before the last bit of dirt is covering you, that's what it felt like. And it was incessant for 3 months, like day, night, dreams. I couldn't sleep. I was trying to hold on to moments with my family. I was trying to connect, trying to bond. I mean, when they tell you if you knew you had 3 months to live, you'd go live your life the way you need to. I totally screwed that up. That was not where I was. You know, I was like, I need to save my life. And so I spoke to everyone. I told nurses, doctors, every doctor visit. I was like, my placenta previa is going to turn into an accreta. I'm going to hemorrhage. You're going to need blood. I'm going to need a hysterectomy. You're going to have to put me on general anesthesia. The baby's going to, like, it was constant. And, you know, Jonathan went with me to all the appointments. Every test was negative. At one point, we have a friend of ours who was a fellow at the time, a gynecological oncologist, which is ones that do high-risk reproductive organ surgeries. And he's like, Stephanie, why are you stressing about this? And I said, can you just humor me? What happens if during childbirth I need a hysterectomy? And he's like, first of all, you're not going to need it. I said, okay, can you just tell me what happens? He's like, well, your OB wouldn't be able to do the surgery, so they'd transfer you to maternal fetal medicine. But really what you want is a gynoc to do it because of all the surgical experience they have with high risk. And when 20% of your blood supply is going to your uterus, this would constitute that. So I actually made an appointment with the head of gynec at Northwestern Memorial Hospital. And, you know, they finally took the appointment. And Jonathan's sitting with me in the waiting room. And he's like, we're seeing women who are suffering from cancer, who have IVs in their arm, who have no hair on their heads. And he's like, I am embarrassed to be here. And I said, I don't know what to tell you. All I know is everybody sees an open road, and all I see is this 18-wheeler headed straight for me. Maybe this doctor has heard of something like this, and maybe, you know, there's something else going on that is not physiologically happening, but it's or might be happening, and I just can't tell with what the tests that they've been doing. And, you know, and so we go in, we have the meeting with this doctor and his resident, and she's taking notes, and the doctor says, you know, how can I help you? I said, doctor, you know, I see you, you see me. Jonathan's like, it was very mafia-like. Like, I see you, you see me, you're not my doctor. And he says, you know, I said, look, I'm, you know, my placenta previa is going to turn into accreta. You're going to have to give me a hysterectomy at the time of birth. And he sits back and he says, Mrs. Arnold, have you been on the internet? And I'm like, why, yes, I have, doctor. But this is going to happen.
Yeah.
And so, you know, of course, Jonathan's like, your Latina came out, like my neck roll came out. And I'm like, let me tell you something. This is going to happen. And so he goes, okay, Ms. Arnold, why don't we get an MRI? And if the MRI is positive for an accreta, I will schedule myself the day of your mandatory C-section at 37 weeks. I was like, okay. And I felt better because I had something to do. And we do the MRI. The MRI comes back negative. And my husband says, you should feel better. And I said, I don't. I feel worse because I'm running out of people to tell this crazy foreboding story to. So my OB said, are you still having those visions? I said, yes. She's like, why don't you have a consultation with anesthesia? I said, okay. I had a phone call with her. Her name is Dr. Grace Lim. And she was like, you know, explaining to me where I'd recover, where wait, epidural, like all these things. And I said, that's great. But what happens in the event this, and this happens? And she said later that she was startled by it, but she kept her composure. And she said, look, Mrs. Arnold, we're prepared for any kind of emergency. We do drills all the time. I hope I made you feel better. And she said she'll never forget the last words I used to her, which were, it is what it is. So I get to that point and I'm like, okay, what else am I going to do? I take to Facebook. I write on Facebook. If anybody has my blood type, I'm going to need it. I write goodbye letters. I send out goodbye letters.
I mailed them. Okay.
Yep. And so there were moments where I was like, I was struggling. And then you're just waiting for D-Day to happen. Not only just your delivery day, but your death day. Like I am so, it's so palpable. The fear is so painful that I know that the day I deliver this child is the day I'm going to die. And so, of course, by 36 weeks to the day, my husband has a business trip in New York and I start bleeding on the kitchen floor. And they say God works in mysterious ways, and I totally believe this. So I get in the car. My nanny was like, you know, I'll drive. You can't drive. You're bleeding. I'm like, I've had many premonitions. Dying in a car accident was not one of them. Get out. So she gets in the car in the backseat. Well, we get triaged at the hospital. You know, I'm texting, Skype chatting with my husband and letting him know how much he means to me. I kiss my daughter, who's 2 at the time, you know, a million times. And, you know, my doctors come in and it's like, it's time. The ORs are quiet and you've been stressed this whole pregnancy. Let's get Jacob out. So I kiss my daughter a million times, and as soon as the gurney takes me down the hall, I break down crying because I'm convinced it's the last time I'm going to see her. And they wheel me right into the OR in the room that's going to give life to my son and take mine. And so it was so heavy, and nobody else is feeling this. I'm the only one that's feeling it. Everybody is doing their thing. They're doing their job. And I can't blame any of the doctors. The reality is the tests were negative. They were going off of the data, you know? And so what happens next is completely inconceivable to anybody who witnessed this, which was I give birth, you know, I'm having a C-section. So there's a curtain in front of my face. And they're preparing me, and they deliver Jacob, and he's healthy and he's happy, as I said. And then seconds later, I'm dead. I ended up having an amniotic fluid embolism, which is a very rare pregnancy complication where amniotic cells get into the mother's bloodstream. And if you happen to be allergic to it, in most cases, you don't survive it. It's a 1 in 40,000 risk. Most doctors will never see it in their lifetime. The first phase of it is cardiac arrest, lungs shut down, you flatline. And if you're lucky enough to be resuscitated, which 40% are, then the second phase starts, which is DIC, which is your body's inability to clot blood. There were things in the OR that I did not predict. And so I flatlined for 37 seconds and I was brought back to life. And the reason that was is that anesthesiologist on that very last phone call, that very last consult that I had, she said she was uncomfortable with what I was saying, had never had a patient speak so clearly about what was going to happen, and had sought out specialists to save her life. And with that one phone call, she flagged my file incorporating extra blood in a crash cart in the operating room. Mm. And that's what saved my life.
And her first name again was?
Grace. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And when I say that God works in mysterious ways, you know, Jonathan to this day feels guilty he wasn't there with me during the delivery. And I said, it's one thing to hear your wife flatline. It's another thing to see it.
Sure.
And you would have been helpless watching this happen, and they would have dragged you out of the OR. So there's no way you would have been able to, and you would have felt even more helpless.
Rare is it? I mean, I got a million questions, but you're answering them as you talk. So it's not for me to interject anything. But the first thing that did pop into my head, and this is fast forwarding to now almost, I mean, it's almost a decade later. And I can't help but think how your presence and this premonition and this ongoing connection that you have to something that was unseen to everybody but you must have changed everybody around you.
It has. It for sure has. Some people don't want to get within my line of sight.
I imagine. Yeah.
They don't want to remember it. They others take it as a heavy lesson to learn, and thank God I'm okay. There's some doctors that, like 3 weeks later, ended up seeing a second amniotic fluid embolism. And lost the patient. There were nurses and people who had witnessed it on the floor who believed in miracles before, but even more so afterwards, and have reached out and said that, your story changed my life and the way that I practice medicine. There's some that share stories that say that in horror that they didn't believe the patient when the patient said that they were going to die, and they did. Mm-hmm. And so my life goals have changed, my calling, if you will. And I feel weird about using that word, but I really do feel like, you know, my entire career in telling other people's stories led me to this moment to help affect change. Mm-hmm. And to help others, and to give them validation and to hear their stories. Because just because you can't see it doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Is that for sure?
And people have a hard time with it. I mean, my logical husband was like, if I didn't witness it, and to this day, he still has trouble when I say something and it comes true. He's like, I'm just going to go with it. I'm like, probably a good idea.
Yeah, right.
At this point, probably a good idea. But for him, it's not a comfortable place. For many people, it's not a comfortable place, because if I'm explaining that there's something energetic, and I'm not saying I know I have all the answers and know how it actually happens. I mean, I don't ask why. I'm grateful that I survived this, but I want to know how it happens, the mechanics of how it works. Yeah. And I'm just not smart enough to understand quantum mechanics, physics, entanglement, all the things that many, many people start discussing. It makes sense. We're made up of energy, that we can feel others. But many of the doctors said, I foreboding exists prior to a cardiac arrest or an embolus, but 3 months before, in the exact detail that you had, no. And so it leaves a big question in my mind that I think I'll always be trying to seek out the dot-to-dot answers.
You know what? I'm thinking, and I'm going to jump back to the 6 days that you were unconscious after that, which is in and of itself is a journey. But I'm thinking about the timing of this conversation that we're having. So, you know, I just met you last year. I met you at the Abbey. I listened to what you had to say, and I watched people, and I kept thinking how many people in this room needed exactly to, you know, hear what Stephanie was offering, and the other people too, but you in particular, because we're having this conversation. And I started thinking about those people down in the hallway. Why were they standing there? What did they need that they didn't even know they needed that day till they walked into work? And now I'm rolling it forward to this conversation we're having, and this podcast goes all over the world. And I have zero idea who needs to hear this, but I damn well sure know somebody does. And one of the things that comes along with that knowing, like you said, is I'm sitting here listening to you talk, and there is a certain stance that people like you who have gone across the fence and came back. I've had it a couple times, not nearly the extent that you have. I think it's different for all of us, but I can appreciate, understand it, and just sit here and nod in my head. If you've not had that experience, it's very, very difficult. Even though you may have had a nudge here or there, this is, I think, validation that the 3 months prior to this event, you got to pay attention to those nudges. You have to. That's what, in so many ways, your story is all about. So this all takes place, and then you're unconscious for 6 days.
Yeah, so I get transferred from the OR to the surgical ICU, which is when Jonathan arrives. And so when he gets there, he finds out what happened. And then the anesthesiologist that was the attending on my case, different from Grace, explained, you know, that prognosis is not great. There's no guarantee. Do yourself a favor. Don't look up what an amniotic fluid embolism is. But he does, and he says it wasn't a conscious, it was conscious that he said what he said, which I'll tell you next, but I feel like something else was pushing, but he'd never admit to it, so I'm not going to argue it. But he basically said, if she needs a hysterectomy, this is the doctor we met with. Mm-hmm. And the anesthesiologist took note of it and was curious as to why he even visited a gynecological oncologist. But, you know, she said, look, you know, she's not stable enough to have another surgery, and we think we've controlled the bleed. And so they just move on. And then Jonathan sees me, and it's got to be conflicting because you've got a brand new baby boy who is, you know, a light in his life, his first boy, and he's got the love of his life on life support. And he's listening to the machines breathing for me. And, you know, it's got to be a lonely place in that moment to be like, she said all of these things. How is this even possible? I don't even know if it was conscious for him to go through like the past few months of the conversations we had, but you know, he writes his feelings down in the book, so you could see how painful it is. But you know, at 7 hours later, the bells and whistles go off, and it turns out I'm still bleeding. And they take me back to the OR, and they call the gynoc to perform the hysterectomy. The pathology on the uterus showed that an accreta had started to form, but at the time when they did the MRI, it was undetectable. And everything happened the way I said it was going to happen. The only thing is, I didn't know that I was going to survive, for sure. So I was in a 6-day medically induced coma. My kidneys had failed. I had started dialysis. And in the Jewish religion, when you have a boy, on day 8, you have to do a circumcision. And so Jonathan called the rabbi, and the rabbi's like, you know, and he's like, I want my wife to be there. We'll hold off. He's like, as long as the baby is healthy, you have to do the circumcision. And he's like, I don't, but I want her to be there. What do I do? And he's like, you pray. And he's like, Rabbi, I don't, what, you know, like, I don't,
right.
I'll, you know, what am I, this is not, the, I don't know whether he thought to himself, this is not going to help. I don't really know what went on in his mind, because I was unconscious at the time. But he ultimately did whatever he needed to do. The community gathered together, doctors, clinicians from all over, different denominations, religions, prayed. And on the 6th day, they took down the meds, and then the very first thing I said as I was extubated, because I was swollen and I had severe edema, I'm like, am I still fucking pregnant? And Jonathan at that moment was like, I think she's gonna be okay.
Yeah, she's back. Okay.
But you know, it was a long haul, because you know, I stayed in the hospital another 3.5 weeks, and you know, everybody looked at me as I was the walking dead. I was the highest acuity case in the maternity ward. I had every department in me, on me, around me, asking me how it is that I knew. It was really well documented. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't know. Why don't you tell me? This is a teaching hospital. And they were like, I think you need to go spiritual on this one. And I'm listening to some of these doctors who really are grounded scientifically, but when they witness things that they cannot explain, they don't have the information yet, or they have, they've just seen so much that they don't believe that that will ever show up as far as an explanation. It's way well beyond what we have the capacity to understand. Mm-hmm. So I get out of the hospital, I'm in a wheelchair, I'm doing outpatient dialysis. The recovery took a while. I couldn't read children's books. I couldn't be a mother. I couldn't be a wife. I was angry. And I was completely disconnected. So if I think back, which is really interesting that we're having this conversation, and I led it with, because no one's really ever asked me the question of that, you know, was there some sort of, you know, awakening, that shift where I went to go to China and everything, like the details, and I'm just now piecing this together as we're talking. The interesting thing is at this point in my life, I was completely severed from my soul and my body. So here it was, I had, and I'll talk a little bit more about the therapy that I did, but I was so disconnected with this body. My mind, my psyche ached, and my soul just felt like it was too big in this body, that I was just uncomfortable again at this stage of my life. And then I was angry with everybody who didn't listen to me. And then that probably brought up childhood trauma of not being listened to and whatever it was. Mm-hmm. It was like, okay, this is not all mine. This is not all my shit. So yeah, yeah. I'm going to own my shit.
Cyclical.
Right. Yeah. I'm going to own it, but I need to figure it out. And so something shifted when I went to traditional therapy, and everybody was like, you dodged a bullet. Everything is fine. You know, Jonathan kept saying, let's suppress, repress, move on. Typical military or man reaction. It's like, let's move on. And this therapist said, you didn't dodge a bullet. The bullet hit you dead on. You survived the bullet.
Huh.
And it's a
very different way to look at it.
It is. That shifted everything for me. Like, that was worth its weight in gold, because at that moment I had to honor. If you've watched other interviews I've done on TV, like, I kind of gloss over the fact that I died and moved on and let's get to the next part of the story. But it was, I had to deal with the moment of impact. I had to deal with the fact that I was physically and literally laying dead on a table. And I like to just gloss over it. And I wasn't honoring it enough to be like, no, I have to really feel what this felt like. Not that I wanted to, but I really felt that I needed to do that in order to release the cells in the body that remember trauma. So I ended up finding a regression therapist, because I was on a talk show and the host said to me, "Did you see the light?" I'm like, "I don't know, man. They gave me a lot of drugs. I have no idea." But I thought that was irresponsible of me, because if there was a way to find out, then I was going to go find out. But I wasn't afraid to say, "It's one life to live. That's it. You're kaput. It's over." But if there was something else, I owed it to myself to see if there was some way of understanding that exists. So I found a regression therapist in Miami, and she got licensed to work with me in Illinois. And we did it over telehealth now. And I, under hypnosis, so basically regression therapy takes you back to the moments of traumas. And in the way that they work with hypnotherapy, it's like, it's different than when it originally happened. So you're an observer in your own life. Mm-hmm. And hopefully with that, you can see your surroundings. And I was hopeful that maybe I could see what was happening during those 3 months, because I felt it so strongly that maybe I'd have some answers there. And then I had, and then I was like, all right, and if there was a way to find out what happened in 37 seconds or when I was in a coma, I would like to know that too. And it was a very tall order, but I had never been hypnotized. So I was like, I was going to record it. Maybe that's my reality TV background. But I was like, if someone's going to make me quack like a duck, you know, every time I say hello, I want evidence. And so you see me on the videos, and I did many, many hours of therapy, but ultimately she got me back into the OR. And when she got me back into the OR, you see me physically like convulse and seize and gag. And then you hear me talk about everything that happened in the OR, like after I flatlined, like where the doctors were, who hit the button for the code, which nurse jumped on my chest to give me CPR, what was happening down the hall, what my husband was wearing off a plane. Like there were just like all of these different moving parts. And then I saw spirits, hundreds and hundreds of spirits, some people that I knew, family members that have passed, and then ones that I didn't know. And, you know, people are like, oh, well, that's a lot of download in 37 seconds. I said, look, I don't know how it works, but I said, I think time and space don't exist in this other dimension. So you can have a lot of download. But again, I am no expert. It's just what I received. And so I can't tell you that I got that information when I was in a coma or when it was exactly linear 37 seconds, but I saw a ton. And because I had it on video, and after that specific session, the therapist is like, you know, I just felt like a whole weight had been lifted off my shoulders. Like I felt a release. So something happened. And I said, well, how do you know what I'm telling you is just not a fabricated story from my reality TV show days? Like, how do you know, whatever? And she's like, you know, sometimes the only validation we get is the patient feels better and you feel better. And I said, that's not good enough. I have witnesses. Mm-hmm. So I went back to the doctors who were present with the tape in hand, and I played it for them. And one looked like she was about to break down and cry. Grace was like, well, it wasn't like an embolus, like where you flatline. It was more like a seize and gag. And I showed her the video, and she starts crying. And she says, wow. She's like, I said, did it look anything like this? And she's like, it looked exactly like that.
Wow.
And then I had kept telling my doctor, which you can hear her and see her on the Netflix show that we're on, and on that Surviving Death. Mm-hmm. And so she said, you know, I kept saying to her, I said, did you say this can't be happening? This can't be happening. Because mind you, this is the doctor I'm telling for 3 or 4 months. This is right, 3 months and this is going to happen. This can't be happening. She's like, I did, but in my mask, under my breath, far away from your ears, there's no way you could have heard that. I mean, it was accurate down to where everybody was standing. And in fact, when I went back to the hospital to thank people, there was one manager who came up to me. She's like, Mrs. Arnold, you don't remember me. I said, you're the one that broke my ribs. And she was stopped dead in her tracks. And she said, and I do it again to save your life.
Oh, wow.
And well, she walked back her office. The CNO of the hospital said, she walked back to her office devastated because you shouldn't know that.
When I was asked before about people changing because of this, you know, to me there becomes, it's like a puzzle. Pieces laying everywhere. And as I'm watching and listening, I've watched you do this with a group of people in a room, and I'm listening to you in my ear talk about this. And once again, it's like there's a box, you shake it up, and you got to find all the pieces. And as you're assembling the pieces for us, once again, I'm seeing how many people that lives were changed, which they had no idea were going to change through this great trauma that you experienced. That it was truly a ripple effect. It had spread out. You know, you were, as you said, you were the one that took the bullet head on, but everybody around you in some concentric ring form has to ask the question that they may have never asked before about here and there, life, death, in between, all that stuff. It's one of the most, I don't know if the word's taboo, but it's a subject that people shy away from. You know, everybody thinks they're going to live forever. And as far as I know, that's not the case. So we stay away from that stuff. So here you are going through that for 37 seconds and then coming back and saying, look, I already saw all this and here's exactly what happened. So that's for them to kind of disseminate. But between that time and now, you know, you've written the book that's done very well. You've been, as you mentioned, you're on Netflix with that show. And it seems like you've become a bit of a reluctant messenger in all of this.
That is true. I will tell you, John, it's taken me a long time to own my faith. And
Whoa, back up. Will you say that again?
It's taken me a long time to own my faith.
Own my faith. Mm-mm-mm. Okay.
I have always had faith in God. I've constantly been pulled back to Yiddishkeit, like to Judaism and my faith, but I've always been wanting to understand spiritualism in different cultures and how they deal with energy healing and spirituality and like what makes them tick on a totally different plane. And because of who I am married to, and he most certainly is the love of my life and my soulmate, there was a way to communicate with him to make, and he would do anything for me. He loves me. He wanted to believe me. It took me a long time to realize that he did the best that he could with the tools, the way his brain works.
Yep.
And so until I got to the point where I could forgive that he wasn't there, because really you're asking somebody who believes that purple is the color purple, and mm-hmm. there's no swaying right. that. And so when I reminded him of a moment, and this is early on, like 14 years ago, early on, he's like, you know, I didn't get full disclosure on this whole spiritual stuff. I said, you know what? Screw you. You actually did. So it just a quick story and then come back to this. Just remind me so my ADHD doesn't go off the rails. So when we were in Tulum in Mexico, I took him on his first vacation where, you know, a girl was taking him on vacation, right? So I take him and I'm like, look, this isn't the Ritz. This is like eco shower in the ocean. Hmm. But I was there to learn from these shamans. And so this was after China. I'd come back. I had booked this trip to work with these Mayans, these shamans. And so we're in the ocean. The wave hits me in the back of my head and hits the back of his head. And I hear crack. We both hear it. And I broke my nose. Like, it was so, you could hear it. It was like painful. And so I look, he's like, oh my God, are you okay? I'm like, look, I had my nose done when I was 21. Is it still in the same place? So He's like, yes, but it's swelling and it's, I see the bruising story. I said, as long as it's in the same place, take me to, I said, take me to the shaman.
Yeah.
And he's like, what? I was like, just take me to the shaman. So we go to the shaman in this little tiki hut. I go in 20 minutes later, the swelling, the bruising is gone. I'm like, okay, let's go to lunch. And he's like, what just happened? And I was like, I could explain it, but you wouldn't believe it, but you witnessed it. So let's just move on. It doesn't matter. So I forgot about all of those things and just accepting him for what, like, I desperately, like, honestly, John, if you think about the moments life were just easier before you pierced
woke
this
up.
Veil.
Yeah.
And how ignorance really truly is bliss because you're not feeling things empathetically the way that you are now. I mean, I see things in the Ukraine and my heart, and I'm helpless and I'm like, I need to do, like, I feel it all in every thread of my body. And so life would have been so much simpler if I would just own his version of what his belief system was. Does that make sense?
Cut, like, and dry, just, black and white, right and left, done.
It would be math. Mathematics, simple equation. Right.
Well, you know, and one of the things that my experiences, I was 19 years old, I got electrocuted, gone. I woke up with the guy who was the pharmacist that just coincidentally stayed late that night, never did, brought me back. And you know, that changed me, but it didn't last. And then the second one came when I was 27 in a major car accident. Second time gone, covered me up, had to cut me out of the car. I had the similar experience that you had where I could see everything and smell everything and knew everything, and I shouldn't. But then I was back. But I did not see the light. I didn't go floating around. You know, it was none of that stuff. But what's changed in me over time wasn't right away. Some of it was immediate, but most of it was my empathy. Because before that, I could give a shit.
Right.
And you're 100% right, Steph. It's, you know, there's something about real when you wake up, however you're woken up, and I'm not talking about the woke thing, bullshit that's going around. I'm talking about when you wake up spiritually and you wake up from who you used to be, you realize the rest of the world, for the most part, is asleep. And
that,
there's nothing
painful.
More. It is. It's extremely painful. So that's when you connect with someone like you and I may connect, or someone else at the conference, or somebody, when they've had those experiences, it shifts things. What's also interesting to me is there's a lot of people I've met. You know, I've written the third book I wrote, the last one that came out, Sacred Moments, Messages, Memories, and Other Shit I Can't Explain. I have people that I've known for very long who read it, and some of the things that have happened in there for me and around me and to me, and they start telling me stuff that happened to them, but they would never tell anybody because they needed permission to do that. So in the last
That's what I find in the medical conferences, too, because I speak at a lot of hospitals and institutions, and, you know, it gives them permission to pull me aside and say, I believe in everything you're seeing. I witnessed it. I had a mother that was like this. I've seen it happen here. I don't know how I knew this. I didn't listen before. And, you know, and so you hear it, and I'm like, I wish the clinicians would speak up more. You know, that way people will be less afraid to talk about their quote unquote crazy foreboding or the things that they're feeling, because they want to duck and be like, well, if the doctor doesn't see it, then it's not happening. I'm just going to duck.
Right. Yeah. And I think the other thing that has come for me along with this empathy is I find myself over time reaching out to people I never would have before.
Yeah.
Listen, I came from Chicago. I'd rather, you know, sit, drink a beer, watch the Bears, and call it a day. But that option left me a very long time ago. Every time I try to go back to that, I can't stuff myself in that shell anymore. So I get to be this guy, and that's fine. And I find myself reaching out, doing things that back in the day, and there are guys that I played semi-pro football with that to this day go, what the hell happened to you? And I'm like, well, you really don't want to go through this to get to this point. But this ability to reach out, it makes a profound difference. And when I saw you at the Abbey doing that, I can't quite explain it. I kept feeling like, how do I explain this? Almost like in fourth grade, and kids are learning something they've never heard before, but they know they're going to need someday. And as you're talking about these experiences that you've gone through, somewhere down the line, they're going to need the lessons. They may not repeat the same experience, but the lessons are there for them. So in the last couple of minutes, I just got two things for you. One is, I'm fascinated about your grandmother. So did you know her? Was she alive? Did you know her as a young girl?
Yeah, so she was alive until I was 10. Wow. The very first instance I had with that kind of intuitive ability was my father, you know, where the family went on a family trip, and I felt a really sharp pain in my chest. And I looked at my father and said, "Have you spoken to Abuela?" And he's like, "Well, it's late. I'll give her a call in the morning." And that was the moment that she had a fatal heart attack.
Uh-huh.
So I was enmeshed with her energy, no question.
And so through all of this, as you're talking, you told me you kind of look like her and all this was going on. And yeah. I'm thinking there's some sort of something there obviously connecting. And you already know that.
Yeah, but it's taken me a long time, you know, and that's the thing. And you know, once you turn 50, it's like, okay, you know, I don't have a friend of mine said, and I'm sure it happens earlier for some people and some people later, but you know, you get to a point where you're like, okay, it's my truth, and I don't have to spend the rest of my life proving my truth. I was spending so much time, I think, and it gets back to that faith. I spent so much time proving my truth to my husband, who was the most important person in my life and still is. But I spent so much time proving to him that that became my everyday vernacular. And anybody that would, even if they believed it wholeheartedly, I was like, no, but let me tell you more. Let me give you more documentation. Let me tell you that, because I felt like I needed to do that. And now I no longer feel like I need to do it. And he gave me the freedom to do it. He's like, honey, just because I don't speak the same language as you, I don't deny that this happened. I witnessed it. It's hard for me to swallow.
Right.
But he's like, I won't deny that he's like, even with the lawyers he works with, they're like, but come on, your wife's story, really? He's like, you didn't see what I saw.
Right. And I think that's what permeates much of the world. You know, we all have our belief systems and we live by those. It's a ladder we run up and down every single day. And when something comes along and shakes that, we don't know what to do with it. It's our very identity is tied up into our beliefs and however those beliefs come to us. But that's for another show. You've had about a zillion aha moments out of this experience, that I know. But if there was one you could kind of focus in on, the big aha, like here you are a decade later from all of this, the book, the Netflix series, all the talks you've given, the people you've worked with, but when that's all kind of moved off to the side, you have a few minutes alone by yourself, is there an aha that pops in your mind about how this has not only changed you, changed other people, or what you think you're kind of here to deliver the mail on?
Yeah, I think that the biggest key for me is, you know, I leave it to other people to talk about life beyond the veil. I don't discourage it. I don't, you know, close my ears to it. I don't, you know, I believe it exists wholeheartedly. I don't believe that that's my calling. What I believe is that I'm here to be an advocate for others, and especially be the bridge between the clinicians and patients. And that if you sense something, say something, because it can and will save your life. So in intuition, as we think about it, as mother's instinct, gut instinct, premonitions, this kind of knowing, you know, I believe that it comes from a higher power, and we can all be hardwired for it. It doesn't make a difference. Like I tell scientists and skeptics and spiritualists the same thing. It does not make a bit of difference whether you believe that you need to know how it's hardwired or not, but you cannot deny its existence, because ultimately it can save your life.
My thanks to Stephanie Arnold for taking time out of her day to share her experience with us. And I'm saying that cordially, because I truly do thank her for taking time out. But when you get to a certain point where she's at, this is all you do on some level, right? No matter where you go. She and I were talking a little bit off the air about, I feel much the same. These events that happened in my life, I used to think they were accidents. They're incidents. They're different. One's an accident, not supposed to happen. An incident is something that I believe is part of your path. And when I realized that, things started to shift. Didn't always like it, mostly don't understand it, but I accept it. And I think no matter where I go or what I do, that's always on me to be in that presence and that energy. And Stephanie's the same way, whether she's out speaking in, you know, front of 1,000 people or at the supermarket, she's doing what she needs to do. And that's what being awake is all about. I wish I could explain it a different way, but I can't. It's like sleepwalking, right? People are walking around and they look like they're awake, but they're actually asleep, walking around. And life does that to us in so many different ways. It basically puts us into a coma of sorts. And if you spend all your time in the headlines, you will totally miss the lifelines. And life is not about that. Now listen, that doesn't dismiss this, all the stuff going on in the world, the shit that's flying left and right. I get that. But you have to, at some point, pull back and see what is it that I can do where I'm at with what I have to offset that energetically. Otherwise, you're just stuck in a state of helplessness and negativity. And so you can't control that stuff. But what you can control is your response to that stuff and how you ingest it or digest it or not. So if you want to pick up Steph's book, it's a great read. It's an amazing piece of work. 37 Seconds, Dying Revealed, Heaven's Help, A Mother's Journey Back. You can get it at Amazon.com. Or you can go to Steph's website, stephaniearnold.net, and you can order the book there or book her for a speech. You can also see on her Meet Stephanie page the Surviving Death episode that she's on from Netflix. These are the people that I get to spend time around. Makes my life a lot better, meaning that, you know, if you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always got. These are people who stop doing what they always did. Their life was one direction, and then there was this intervention, and there was this event that happened in life, and they didn't pick up their life as it was before they went in a new direction. Unbelievable stuff to me. This is the thing that makes the world go round, a thing I have such high respect for. I appreciate you listening from around the world. Safe travels. Until next time, be well. Adios.